Welcome to Venturi's Voice. I'm Andy Davis. Venturi's Voice brings together thought leaders from a variety of industries who are taking the most innovative approaches to leadership and staffing. Imagine having a mix of experienced mentors sharing their secrets on leadership, recruiting, onboarding, engagement, and motivating, as well as stories on life lessons they've learned along the way. And it's free. If you're the head of a major corporation leading a team of hundreds or about to take on your first leadership role, this podcast is for you. This show is about you, and we're here to help you become the best leader you can be. Stay up to date with the latest shows by subscribing on iTunes and SoundCloud, as well as signing up to the newsletter at venturi-group.com, where you can find the latest IT jobs, talent, and blogs on all things leadership, staffing, and development. I'd love to hear from you, so drop me a line anytime via email at andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback or requests are always welcome. Enjoy the show. Today's guest is Owen Woods, the CTO at Endava. Anyway, great to have you on the show. First and foremost, the most important thing I saw on the CV was that you went to Manchester University in the 90s, which must have been, you must have spent some time at the Hacienda Club.
Well, actually, I wasn't a full-time student. So, well, firstly, thank you for having me. It's nice to be here. But I was a part-time student. So, sadly, the Hacienda Club didn't figure very very largely. So, it was a modular degree. So, I was out in industry working, and I was sort of based at Manchester, but I actually did modules all over the country. I went to Brighton and Brunel, and I went to Glasgow. And a few other places, including Manchester. So I've been to Manchester, but not nearly as much as you'd expect from someone who has a degree from the university.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just always compelling. Like, 90s in Manchester, I mean, I think that was a pretty good time to be in and around the city. But, yeah, anyway, I had to ask about that. Get the important.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, it was a little bit before I was quite old enough to go to clubs in the 90s. So I just missed out on that. My uncle was kind of a part of that club as well. So he, sure he had some nights.
He's got some good stories.
Yeah. Well, he won't tell me any of them, but I'm sure he has. You know, he's in a different kind of life stage now. But yeah, I mean, it's great to have you on the show. You know, I want to obviously talk. There's quite a lot I want to cover with you, I suppose. But, you know, first and foremost, obviously, you have a background in engineering. So I think so everyone can kind of familiarize, you know, what was kind of the, you know, as we just said, you know, you were in Manchester, you were kind of studying in around engineering. What was that kind of the initial driver for you? Were you always kind of interested in engineering and the technical side of the work, you know, from a young age? And if not, I suppose, how did you kind of progress into being interested in computers and engineering in the first place?
Yeah, sure. So I was one of that generation who grew up with ZX81s and Commodore 64s and BBC Micros. So I didn't actually do computing at school, but I was quite aware of computing through home computing, and you know, I taught myself to do basic programming, and a number of my friends were quite interested in it. So it sort of became a hobby thing, which I realized during my sixth form I was going to have to study something, and I didn't really know what I was going to do. But then I discovered that there was this subject called computer science, and that really led me into it through interest in the fundamental technologies. So I spent 4 very good years at Brunel University in West London, studying computing with economics, which was an interesting mix. There weren't many of us doing that. And then I joined a company called Bull, who were at the time a large French computer manufacturer. And I was very fortunate. I approached Bull and explained I wanted to do a master's degree, and much to my surprise, really, and I was very pleased that they said, that's fine, we'll sponsor it. So they sponsored me through a degree, and I discovered Manchester, which was a fantastic place to just be, because really terrific people and marvelous city to be in, and also really great computer science departments. So I then spent, I think, about 3 years doing part-time study in Manchester and other places, and that led me to my MSc. So, yeah, the roots of all this go back a long way to a ZX81 in the 1980s.
Brilliant. And it's been a bit of a kind of a theme as well on the show, actually, to, you know, think about kind of education and the part that it plays now, in especially in technical people's kind of
it's really not. A lot of people seem to be skipping that kind of stage of the university phase these days, and kind of because they can, it's so much more accessible to kind of learn things from home, and much easier to kind of develop your skill set from home. So people are kind of, you know, not looking at university as kind of the logical choice as much these days. For you, how big of a role was it for you in kind of the developmental stages of you? And do you still back that notion that you think it's kind of paramount to get that experience, whether, you know, it just because of kind of the learning stage, or do you think it's more kind of the experiences really where the value add is for that kind of university education?
I think these things go in phases, actually. You sort of, when you've been in the industry a while, as we both have, you see trends come and go and come back again. But I completely agree with that point about it's just being possible to learn today in so many ways. I mean, sites like Coursera and Khan Academy, they just didn't exist 10 years ago. So it's certainly possible today to piece together a lot of computer science education, either free of charge or at very low cost, by taking courses from really great universities, but distance delivered, probably without much interaction. You just sort of, you get the videos and you do the exercises and they mark them. I think that's definitely got its place. And in technical education, especially in Britain, we have a long, really proud tradition of apprenticeship. In fact, my nephew is a really senior aeronautical engineer, works in the maintenance field there, and he left school, had no interest in university at all, went to his employer with O-levels, and then did the classic OND, HND degree, got a first-class degree, and is now a chartered engineer. So, you know, this has been happening for a long time. I think software engineering and computing in general, there are different kinds of work, and different educational paths probably suit different kinds of work and, frankly, different kinds of people. I'm certainly a big believer in a kind of apprenticeship-based approach. Where I think we've got to be a little bit careful is the new kind of emergence of the code camp, the sort of 12-week training program, which, if you can harness people's enthusiasm, and use those 12 weeks to really build some very foundational knowledge and then get them into a structured training program, that's fantastic. The thing I worry about is that people do the 12 weeks and think that's it. And there's so much more to know. I mean, after 12 weeks, I don't think you even know what you don't know. And so I worry a bit about those people that the code camps are a little bit, dare I say it, shortchanging them. They're building great foundations and harnessing some enthusiasm, but there's an awful lot of fundamentals people aren't getting from them. So I think what I'd love to see in the industry is more really good progressive apprenticeship type programs where people can go and do something for 12 weeks, or they can just come in with their A-levels, no experience at all, and then in the workplace they get structured education and loads of experience, and that's a really good way to learn to be an engineer.
So yeah, I kind of agree with that. I think that there is more, so I guess essentially there needs to be more responsibility on the employer to be willing to kind of develop programs internally, you think, and to bring people through.
Yeah, I think there is a big role for the employer. And I think in Britain in particular, we have offices in many countries, and I see, you know, there's different employer cultures in different places. But I do see in Britain in particular, there has been a reluctance on the part of employers to set up what they perceive to be expensive training programs. And it's, I mean, there is some government support for that, which is good, but we could certainly do with more of that.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think, well, I think maybe it's kind of a mix of incentivizing companies from a government level to be motivated to build these programs. I think that's probably where there's been some friction. And I think that there needs to be that kind of support there to bring people through. You know, my kind of take on it is I have a little bit more of a hard position on, you know, universities. I think that, you know, talking from a classic startup background here, you know, I think that the next big thing to be disrupted completely is education. I think that is the next big thing, not just in this country, but just, you know, all over the place, that will be, you know, completely disrupted. You know, you look at, you know, it's the only business that's kind of being diluted, the value of a degree is being diluted, but yet the prices are still going up. You can only get away with that for so long. So I think that there needs to be, you know, alternative routes. And then an understanding from a macro level that these alternative routes are just as valuable as going to whatever X big name university. So it's kind of there, and then the understanding from the corporate side as well that, you know, these qualifications and this kind of CV resume is just as valuable as someone who went to, I don't know, University of Cambridge or something like that. So, but I do think that there's a big opportunity for disruption there. I'm not quite smart enough to figure out exactly how that's going to work, but I am kind of a big advocate of that. I think the caveat there, and you know, you might be able to speak on this yourself, because I think that, you know, external influences on our lives and experiences can essentially shape you a lot more than kind of class time. You know, I'm sure that, you know, throughout your life, you've had certain influences that might not have been directly through work or education, but, you know, through just life, people you meet and new experiences and, you know, taking risks and stepping outside your comfort zone. These kind of things are super valuable. And I think that, you know, university definitely provides an element of that. But as far as kind of the core curriculum, I think there's a lot to be disrupted there from my personal opinion. But yeah, I mean, again, for me, I went to university and the experience for me, the take that I got from it, it was really more about kind of the experience than necessarily the education to the fullest. I mean, you know, I my degree was in economics and, you know, I really valued that kind of degree. But, you know, I think a lot of the things I've almost developed my understanding more outside of the realms of the classroom rather than inside it. But yeah, it's an interesting point. And I suppose, you know, when we look at, obviously we're kind of involved in recruitment and staffing, when you think about that, you know, it's kind of does play when we're trying to place people in, you know, certain companies, and there's still barriers to entry there because of, you know, kind of education and or university that they went to and their technical people. It's sometimes doesn't always make sense.
Yeah, I think different organizations probably have different cultures around this, and frankly I think that there's room for all the different models. I mean, I think, in my view, the huge disruption is going to be in white collar jobs in the coming 10 to 15 years. Means that really we could do with all the education we can get, however it's delivered. And certainly, there's a role for traditional, more academic courses with their rigor and teaching people critical thinking. There's almost certainly also there's plenty of room for more vocational and practical based courses. And in Britain, I think we've often neglected the latter. We've developed eight universities. We've tried to copy that model for everybody, which doesn't really work very well. And we haven't really thought very critically about what is it that somebody who is less academic but still has plenty of talent to offer, what is it they need in modern education?
Yeah, it's... Well, I think it's above my pay grade anyway. I wish I had an answer. I'd be really surefire if I just hit you with a pre-made answer there, wouldn't I? That would have made me look particularly cool. That
would be very, very, very impressive. Yeah. we'd all be guilty tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, maybe next time. Maybe next year. If I do enough of these, maybe I'll learn enough, and then maybe I'll go for it. So I want to kind of talk a little bit more about kind of, you know, the skills that you acquired and how you kind of thought about career progression and things that kind of pique your interest. And it's a nice question I quite always like quite asking people from technical background is whether, you know, you kind of moved from place to place or you took on different projects. For you, was it the technical challenge that kind of initially motivated you to go for something? Or was it kind of the product itself? Like, what were the main contributors for you being motivated about a product or a project or moving to a company? And, you know, what were kind of the main things that made you go, aha, right, I'm going to go for this?
There were nearly always two things, or there have nearly always been two things. One is that I'm going to learn quite a bit, so that it may, of course, use knowledge I've got already, but I want to be learning new stuff. And also, is it a supportive environment? Is it? I've interviewed, especially in the finance sector, for a number of organisations that I thought I might learn plenty here, but I'm not sure I'm going to be supported in growing all that well. Partly because often those organisations don't really understand the needs of technical people and how they work and the fact that they're a bit different to business people. So those are the two things I've always needed, because one, you want to keep on growing, but two, if you're not in an environment where you think the culture's right, either you won't enjoy it, so you won't be very effective, or you just may not be able to grow the way that you think you have the potential to do.
Right. Yeah, I think that's so... it potentially, you know, I speak from experience here, I suppose, but such an overlooked rationale for taking on something is, you know, the how are you going to learn and progress? I think that's massively overlooked for people. I think that the other things tend to be prioritized in a lot of people's cases. But, you know, I think, you know, you look at your kind of career and how that's progressed. I think it's a testament to being kind of that always thirsty for to learn and progress. That'll just always continue. So, yeah, I think I always encourage people to try and, you know, approach things from that perspective. What can I learn? Not always, what can I tell them? You know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, completely agree. So I've always been thinking, not exactly two steps ahead, but I've always been thinking, where does this job take me? As opposed to what am I going to be doing in the next couple of months?
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. And I think that's probably kind of held you steady, I suppose, throughout your career. Is there, you know, any particular cases where that was particularly obvious that it was kind of like, I could have gone one way for, I don't know, something like more money or whatever, but I decided to go kind of the other way. Was it always kind of a conscious choice as you made moves?
Yes, it's normally been a pretty conscious choice to decide to prioritize some kind of learning, growth, expansion of you know, my sphere of influence, or I mean, something like that. That's normally been why I wanted to do it. And most of the jobs I've taken, actually, I've taken them because it looked to me as if there was that element in the job. I haven't always been correct, but actually I've been pretty fortunate. In most jobs I've taken, I've ended up growing quite a lot through the job.
Yeah, that's fantastic. That's really fantastic. And when you look at, you know, technical people now, developers, engineers, to the rate has changed that technology is growing at now, I think that it's almost paramount that they are and acquire though that kind of a skill set and are motivated from that regard to continuously be interested in learning and developing, because you don't really have a choice. So I think to be outstanding or be a good engineer now, I think you have to be that way inclined. Would you not agree?
Yeah, completely. It's that this is almost, in fact, when I'm, you know, overseeing hiring, or I'm trying to hire someone, or I'm encouraging, you know, we have huge recruitment teams here, what we're to look for, I'm always saying we need to look for the fundamentals and the attitude to keep learning and changing, because the fact that they're an expert C-sharp developer today, we may not need a C-sharp developer tomorrow, and we may need them to do something completely different, but we want to use engineering fundamentals. That's really what we're looking for. Of course, you know, people have specializations. That's absolutely fine. That means that's a good thing. You've got to be an expert at something to be effective in today's job. But to have that mindset to always be ready for the new challenge and something else tomorrow, that's what I'm always looking for.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's probably quite hard to identify those talents, I would think. Or maybe not, I suppose. I've probably not been around that kind of process enough,
it can be. And also I'm sometimes surprised that, you know, when we do look for people seem quite resistant to learning new things and, you know, moving into new technical stacks and so on. But, you know, some people it's a very natural thing, they always want to learn something new. Other people actually want to sort of consolidate and become expert in one thing, and I think you encourage people towards breadth, but you have to be sensitive to the fact that it makes some people feel very uncomfortable being asked to be very adaptable.
And, you know, speaking of kind of the rate of change of technology as well, it's, got to be quite difficult, especially from someone in your role as a CTO who, you know, is heavily involved in kind of the technical strategy behind things. There is so many new things being kind of thrown at you now. There needs to be a calculated approach, I would assume, to not get sometimes sidetracked by the latest tech in something. That's probably quite tempting to go with the latest thing, but might always not necessarily be what you need to get those results. Is that something that's becoming more and more difficult and to get kind of, you know, stay on track and ensure that, right, there is new, more and more new tech coming around, but how do we kind of keep kind of the high level goal in mind of what we're trying to achieve?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There's a constant tendency for the forward looking client to always want to use the new technology without being quite why the new technology is relevant. The current trend we're seeing in that is blockchain, where we have some good skills in blockchain. You know, we've been looking at it for some time. We've got some, I think, pretty strong ideas what its unique features are and where you might use it. We get a lot of clients approaches with a query, could you do some innovation work, run some labs for us on blockchain? And we say, what's the problem you're trying to solve? And then they'll name a problem, and it's not really very relevant. So we try and point this out, and they go, yeah, I know, but we need to use blockchain. And clearly the objective is to use blockchain, and they're trying to find a problem to fit the technology. And we always try and have that conversation with them about, if you want to solve this problem in a novel way, there might be other technologies. And, you know, some of them are very sensible about it and say, oh, we understand, let's search for something together. Others just want to use blockchain. And you know, it's fair enough. If they want to experiment with blockchain, we're only too happy to run a POC for them. But it is, I think, a bit of a failing in this industry sometimes that we're focused on the new shiny things. And sometimes we lose sight of the fact we're actually trying to solve a business problem in most cases.
Yeah, and that's probably like the moralizer as well for all the techies, because they're like, it's like, I really want to just test out all this new technology. But at the same time, it's like, but yeah, at the same time, we do have to kind of worry about, you know, making money and stuff like that. So
exactly. And stability and reliability and skills access, they're not exciting things, but actually they're pretty important.
And was that, you know, speaking of which, I suppose, you know, when you move into a position like, you know, CTO and go, you know, more of the strategy route, the kind of the management type role, you know, how different of a transition was that for you? You know, when you got to that point in your career when you had to kind of look and kind of, I suppose, be the killjoy and say, sorry, we can't use all these technologies.
It's been quite a big step, actually, until this role, which, you know, today I have the privilege of being the CTO at Endava, which is you know, a really interesting job, and you know, I'm very privileged to work with a lot of very clever people in many countries. Before I've taken this job, my role has generally been focused on a particular system or a group of systems and their evolution. And of course, I've been very concerned about things like, frankly, reliability and access to skills and those, if you like, killjoy things. It's been quite a big step now to have to do it for many industries and many clients and actually set a direction in with a lot less context. That's really the challenge, is that the context is the industry and our quite rapid growth rather than a more bended context, if you like, of a particular business unit that's got a set of systems, which has tended to be the environment I've worked in for the last 10 years or so. And before that, I was working on products. So again, it was relatively bended. There was a product and it had to be evolved. I then moved to, there are many systems working together and they get evolved as a group. And now I have to work in a rather less focused domain where I'm looking at industry trends and I'm looking at trends across client industries, and of course I'm looking at things like what's going to fuel Endava's growth, which are much less tangible, so it is a bit of a challenge.
Yeah, it sounds fascinating though. I think that sounds like I think it would be my idea of it. I think looking at things from more of a macro perspective as opposed to a micro, I mean, it sounds like quite the challenge, but at the same time fascinating nonetheless, and I'm quite envious of that actually. It sounds great, but long way for me to get to the CTO position anyway. Better get the books out. But yeah, so
keep going.
when yeah, that's it. And you know, when you're looking at the industry trends, I mean, obviously you mentioned blockchain. I'm definitely not a skeptic of blockchain. I think that technology is fascinating. But you know, anything else kind of in the space? I mean, I think it's pretty obvious that kind of data, you know, AI stuff like that are particularly compelling at the moment. But when you look at industry trends for you, what do you think is kind of one, I suppose, most interesting to you just on like a personal level, but also what do you think is actually going to be the most applicable that's kind of, I suppose, getting a lot of attention at the moment?
Sure. So for quite a long time, Endava has had really one core message, which was about transforming organizations to be much more agile in how they developed software and worked with their businesses. And then I suppose about 2 years ago, we started doing a lot more work that was explicitly digital. And that has been, you know, a really strong trend. And there's an awful lot of organizations, it's becoming a bit passé now, but there's a lot of organizations who are still really, really struggling to work out what to do with digital and how to evolve their organizations in response to the challenges that digital brings them. If you've got customers connected all the time, comparing you with the competition, wanting rapid change and innovation, is the rest, the digital unit may be able to do that, but how about the rest of the organization? So that's been a trend we've seen, and I think is going to continue for quite a number of years yet. An area of work that we've added to our portfolio more recently is what we call automation generally. And we've done IT automation for a long time, but what you were just alluding to, the business automation stuff, and that's where large-scale data and analytics on that data gives you, first to begin with, insight, and then beyond that, it can lead to what's generally being termed as artificial intelligence, though there are many shades and varieties of that. But that's really causing quite big changes. And there are a few specific technologies in that area, which are, in fact, not so much like AI, but about doing automation for business systems like robotic process automation, that these are all emerging quite quickly, and they seem to be having quite a big effect. And then on the technical side, a trend I'm just starting to see the green shoots of, which I think is going to be very important, is what's being termed serverless computing, which is an unfortunate term, but it's technologies like AWS Lambda, Google Cloud Functions, Azure Functions, IBM OpenWhisk. So this is the ability to deploy a single function, single procedure of code to a cloud and have it treated as a first-class object in the cloud. So you get all the transparency and the cost reporting and the ability to change it that you used to get for a complete virtual machine, you now get for one block of code. So that's a trend that I think we're going to be seeing gaining momentum in the next few years, just as we've seen microservices. So that was the sort of step from going from big services running in VMs to microservices running in containers. That's a trend which is still, I think, very important. And many organizations, again, are just starting out on that journey. But then the next wave that will be hitting, I think, is the serverless wave of technology. So the big things we're seeing is sort of data automation in general, AI, robotic process automation, and systems getting decomposed from really big bits to quite small bits.
Fascinating, interesting. And application-wise as well, is there any kind of examples of, you know, what kind of impact this is going to have on kind of the average worker or the average person that you know, just to kind of draw any kind of example that you can think of?
Yeah, so I alluded to this a little bit earlier, is that actually I think there's going to be a lot of disruption in certain kinds of professional and semi-professional job. To give you a tangible example, we've done a proof of concept and we're now going forward to do rather more serious work around document processing for a large European bank. One of the things that they do is they write a lot of loan agreements. And historically what's happened is that those loan agreements have been scanned or faxed or in some way got into PDF and they're stored. And of course, the loan agreements have covenants in them. That is the conditions that both sides must undertake to uphold. And one of the things that this bank has had a tremendous number of is lawyers who scan the documents looking for the important covenants, highlight them, and then sort of make a note of them somewhere. I think historically it's been in nothing more than Excel. And then more recently, they've had a database of the covenants. So they can both check and make checks on client behavior and also make checks on their own behavior as to whether they're meeting all the covenants. The system that we've developed or are really still developing for them automates that process of finding and extracting and understanding the covenants, which is a great thing because it frees their lawyers up to do tremendously more valuable work. But of course, you can sort of see where this is going. Today, there's a lot of quite junior legal jobs where a lot of the work they do is relatively mundane because they're learning the business. They come out of law school and they need to get experience. So the firms hire them and they do relatively mundane legal work, scanning contracts, assembling contracts, checking contracts and so on. And we can see in the not too distant future, we will be able to do a lot of that by machine using AI. And there's a number of different types of AI needed in the process, and there's a number of different technologies need to be integrated, but a lot of the building blocks are there. It's really a question of putting them together and then tuning them, as in training them often if they're AI models, training them to do a better and better job. And I think this is something society really needs to get on top of. And I personally found a great disappointment in the last general election campaign was no political party was talking about this, whereas actually I think it's beyond Brexit, it's going to be one of the huge challenges facing nearly every developed Western economy in the next 15 years. There's going to be a whole lot of jobs that today are reasonably skilled and reasonably well paid, which actually may not entirely go away, but the number of people we need to do them will drop quite dramatically.
Yeah. Have we seen kind of this rate of change before as far as, you know, people having to reskill, jobs being reduced because, you know, industrial revolution comes to mind. But I think in this instance, potentially we've not seen that change happen so quickly. And I think this is the scare for people and the worry for a lot of people, isn't it, in these kind of medium to low kind of skilled jobs, is the kind of the rate of change in which things are going to happen.
I agree. I mean, I'm generally an optimist. I mean, when I look at things like new technologies and technological change and making things more efficient, it tends to lead to economic growth and in the long term builds more wealth and generally people are better off. So I'm not suggesting that this is a bad thing or that in the long term things won't be better. The problem for me as someone who also studied a bit of economics is it's all about the friction of the short term change, is that a lot of human beings can get caught up very badly in short term change, which removes jobs in the short term and then only builds them or builds different jobs in the longer term. The great example economists give today is if you've got a former steel worker in the Rust Belt in the United States, telling them to go and get a job developing mobile apps is not very realistic. Yet the mobile apps job is better paid, perhaps more secure, certainly safer. So society as a whole may progress, but lots of individuals may be quite badly affected.
Yeah. I do agree with you. But I think any skeptics, I don't think you could have said it any better than that. That was exactly kind of echoes my thoughts on the matter. I think we're at a fascinating time. I think you're in a very privileged position to be in the role that you're in, to kind of, especially at this kind of time where we're looking at the rate of change of technology and all these fascinating things that are happening with data and automation at the moment. So very envious. I'll certainly be keeping an eye on it. And I think, you know, it was a great insight from you there, really fascinating. So thanks for sharing. I'm obviously conscious of time, so I think we'll shut it down here. And I'd just like to say again, thank you so much for taking the time and sharing with us today. I've really enjoyed the conversation, and I hope you haven't minded putting up with me for half an hour or so.
It's been a great experience. Thanks for inviting. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. Please make sure you subscribe at iTunes or SoundCloud, or check out the website venturi-group.com and keep up to date with the latest IT jobs, talent, news and podcasts. Or drop me a line. It's andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback, topics or guest suggestions are always welcome. And thanks again for listening to the show. See you next time.